Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours.
Dr. Rick Shams with us. He's the co-author of Thyroid Mind Power, the proven cure for hormone-related depression, anxiety, and irritability. He graduated from Harvard and University of Pennsylvania, did research in the National Institute of Health, and Nobel Prize winner Marshall Nirenberg, and has been in private practice for 25 years now. In addition to his medical office work, he's been a member of the clinical faculty of the University of California Medical Center in San Francisco, a founding member of the American Holistic Medical Association, a participant in the Carl Menninger Foundation, and a member of Who's Who in California, as well as nationally. And let's say, Rick, hi, welcome to the show.
It is a pleasure, Mike. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, let's lay a base before we go into much further. You know, so many of us hear thyroid. Actually, what is the thyroid? Let's lay a definition out so it'll give us a base for what we want to go to. What is a thyroid, and what effect does it have? What's its job in our physiology?
Absolutely. It's very important. The thyroid is a little gland at the base of the neck, but it secretes a hormone that runs the whole rest of the body. The thyroid is the gas pedal for every single thing that we do, every single thing that our brain does. All the rest of the organs are throttled by thyroid hormone. Too little of it, too much of it, you are not doing well.
Oh, so in essence, okay, so if it, too little, what happens to us?
You get sluggish. Too little thyroid, you become slowed down. You get cool. You get constipated. You get all sorts of mental difficulties like poor memory and depression. Too much of it, then you get speeded up. And you might have digestive irritability. You might have brain irritability where you are anxious or you're having difficulties making relationships work. You can have anxiety. All of this from too much thyroid. Some people actually have phobia and panic.
So let's say, Rick, for instance, let's say I'm in a relationship and we're not getting along too well and I'm getting depressed and I'm irritable and that's causing the problem in the relationship. So I go find myself a psychological counselor and we're doing all of this work back and forth. And what you're saying is it's very possible I could have an underactive or an overactive thyroid triggering this within me, and I'm working on a problem that I don't have as opposed to the one that I do have, and I'm not getting anywhere.
Absolutely. Thyroid drives the brain. See, the brain is what drives the mind, but thyroid drives the brain. Hormones rule metabolism, and the metabolism of your brain, which is relating to all of the thoughts and feelings and emotions and the memory that we can create or have, is related to how well this particular organ will work. And thyroid determines how well it works in a great many cases.
Now, by the way, you have a three-step health program when it comes to thyroid health. And one of the first step was, and we basically touched on it, but it's uncovering that hidden cause for many mental symptoms. How do you find this out? When you get some of these symptoms, you know something's wrong, what kind of a test do you get? Who do you go to find out if this is truly the problem?
Sure. If you are suffering from some of the physical symptoms like fatigue or overweight, and then you have some of the mental symptoms like depression, anxiety, foggy brain, you have sleep difficulties or maybe cravings or downright eating disorders, and you get to have a diagnosis. You get to see if thyroid is abnormal. If your thyroid is abnormal, it's an easy fix. So this is why it's important to get, first of all, a high level of suspicion. People with fatigue, depression, overweight, dry hair, dry skin, dry eyes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, low libido, the sluggishness of bowel function, all of these kinds of things, just being chilly or having cold skin, hair loss, dry skin, you get all of these things from thyroid. If you realize that it might be a thyroid problem and you decide you want to check into it, then you go and get some tests. Okay, you might want to do this, especially if anyone in your family has ever had a thyroid problem. It is the most inherited of all illnesses. So if Aunt Tilly had thyroid, or if your grandmother had thyroid, well, then you are in line for it, and you really ought to get it checked. There are some very, very good blood tests. Standard blood tests are not as good as the new home test technology. You know, you can get a home pregnancy test. Well, nowadays, you get a home thyroid test. You don't even have to ask a doctor for it.
Now, by the way, let me hold you up for a minute, because it brings up a very interesting question. Let's say that I was going through any of this, the depression, the overweight, the dry eyes, whatever the case may be, and I go into the medical doctor, the average practitioner. Are they going to know to look for thyroid problems with this, or could the average doctor just pass it by only because it has not been within his scope of medicine?
The average doctor is very busy and sometimes will look at a situation where a person has a laundry list of symptoms, like I just mentioned, plus they have some depression, and basically they say, look, I don't have time for this, but here's a prescription for Prozac, or go and get some psychological counseling along with it. This misses the point. It misses the underlying problem. And psychological counselors, as well as regular medical doctors, can miss the true diagnosis. And then you spend years with unnecessary chasing symptoms and difficulties that could have been treated very easily. Even Freud, even the great Freud himself, said that eventually many of the illnesses that plague the mind will be found to have a physical cause that will be treated much more efficiently once we know what it is and how to treat it. Well, thyroid is a very common physical cause of everyday psychological problems.
Rick, in your experience, where was it in your life as a doctor, as a practitioner, when you realized the importance of the thyroid? Obviously, everybody knows how important the thyroid is, quote-unquote, in the medical field, but the effect of the thyroid, those symptoms that may not look like they're tied to the physiology.
I got a very good crash course in this. I married a registered nurse who was pretty healthy and then came down with some of these symptoms. She had a thyroid problem. So having her be in better shape, getting her mother in better shape, having our children getting in better shape has been a long and difficult road that is now going much better than I would like to say. Things are going very well now because we've paid attention to some of these fine details about diagnosis and treatment, so you don't have to suffer needlessly.
You know, an interesting point here, it's with your daughter, Georgiana. What she's done with the book in and of itself, we look at the Western culture, Western medicine, but also there is an Oriental medicine culture that has been very effective over the years, and it's very interesting that you combine the both together.
We do combine them together. Georgiana, my daughter, is an acupuncturist and oriental medicine specialist, but she started into this field partly because she had a thyroid problem. It was inherited from her mother. And this particular field, Chinese medicine, is involved in balance. They balance 14 different meridians when they do acupuncture session. So this is the essence of balance, and the essence of good thyroid care is balance. So she is very up on that. Remember, the Chinese are the same people, the same smart people who first discovered the use of gunpowder, rockets, coal, paper money, movable type printing. These are smart folks, and the medical care, the traditional Chinese medicine medical care is very useful.
When you really get into this, and when you take a look at it, and you realize the importance, the criticalness of the thyroid, how strong is the message getting out? Are people beginning to realize, are doctors beginning to realize the effect of the thyroid in the many different areas that you just talked about?
It turns out they are. Now, the psychologists and the psychiatrists have been very involved in thyroid for years and years, more so than regular medical doctors, in terms of seeing its importance for psychological health. But more and more, the word is getting out. More and more doctors are involved in this. But with managed care and with HMO telling doctors that they can spend 5 minutes with the patient, you don't have enough time to do a careful history and find out what are the associated illnesses, what is your family history, what about, you know, all of the things that might lead you to a better diagnosis are not done. And they say you get one test. They give you just one of the thyroid tests instead of a whole panel, and you often get a misdiagnosis because of this managed care situation. People need to take this into their own hands and get some testing on their own. You can simply go to our website and find links to labs that will send you a home test kit. The home test thyroid technology is very accurate, more accurate than putting a needle in your arm at a regular blood lab. The labs that would do a home test kit for you have a higher certification from the governing bodies than the regular labs where you put a needle in your arm. So there's new technology that's spreading around. People are coming aware of just how thyroid has quietly mushroomed into one of the most common illnesses in this country, and it causes minor problems, minor psychological difficulties, everyday depressions and anxieties, as well as major phobia, major depression.
Now, let me ask you this. We're starting to run out of time. Is there a website we can find you at?
Sure. The name of the book is Thyroid Mind Power. The name of the website, www.thyroidmindpower.com. And there's a quick quiz that you can take to find out if you are a likely candidate for this. There are links to these other laboratories that I told you about. There's suggestions for different regular medicines that you can take, or people that are interested in natural alternatives or the Chinese medicine. There's information about all of that. The key to thyroid is a high suspicion and good information.
No, by the way, I think that's it in a nutshell. High suspicion, good information. Rick, we're out of time. And by the way, I want to thank you so much, you know, obviously, for the work you've done. And there's a lot of people out there that really need to hear what you have to say. So get the word out. And thank you so much for joining us.
It is a pleasure. Keep up the good job yourself.
Good night.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice,
Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Simon Mainwaring with us. He is the author of We First, How Brands and Consumers Use Social Media to Build a Better World. And it's so important today. Simon's the founder and CEO of We First, a branding firm specializing in the integration of profit and purpose, and is a prominent blogger and international speaker, and an award-winning former Nike creative at Wieden and Kennedy, and worldwide creator director for Motorola at Ogilvy. And let us say, Simon, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, and thanks to everyone for listening.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. As a matter of fact, when we are dealing with the we today, it is so critically important. Years ago, the we was a couple of hundred people, but the we today are hundreds of millions of people. That's that collaborative effort for people around the globe. Let me ask you this. When you first took a look at this, the we first, the brands, consumers using social media, what was it that caught you? What caught your attention for you to delve into this and really, really bring it to the front?
Well, you know, it was both personal and professional in that despite having had an arguably successful advertising career, I found myself in my early 40s at a bit of a loss. I had had a cool job, I'd had the big job, and yet I was unfulfilled. And that's a little disconcerting when you reach what is supposed to be the sort of better years of your life. And so I think I was looking for meaning, for more meaning and purpose, you know, in my own life. And then, you know, that coincided with the arrival of social media. And as a longtime brand guy who'd worked on projects for brands, like big projects like the Olympics and World Cup, and I'd run global accounts, you know, I'd had experience in trying to architect large shifts in thinking and behavior, and then suddenly this new social media technology came along that made that almost, you know, effortless. And I just thought to myself, it was a gut reaction, I just thought to myself, wow, this is going to be significant, this is going to change our business. This was about early in 2008, so it's a while ago now, but I thought this is going to be a game changer, and that's when I tried to marry some greater sense of purpose through the lens of this technology, and that resulted in the book We First.
You know, by the way, as a game changer, it started with the consumer before it started with the businesses. The advent of the computer, the way the kids think today, the culture, as it changes, marketing has had to take different steps. And if somebody is not abreast of what's going on today, they're going to lose it very quickly and not be able to take advantage of the opportunities that are there. And even though we have what we have today, there are many people, quote unquote, from the old school, who are frightened to death to jump in, touch this, because they're not quite confident in using it.
Right, right. Well, you know, it's interesting. I think part of that problem is a reframing that needs to occur. Too often you hear people saying, I don't have time for social media, or why should I be interested in what strangers are saying to me, and, you know, I don't want to talk to people that much. But really, a better way of looking at this is not through the lens of technology and saying, I don't want to engage with this new technology. A better way is to say, I want to stay in touch with my customers. And this is how they're relating to each other. And this is how they're finding their information and talking about what brands or products or services they support. And so, therefore, I need to go where they are. In which case, you get a whole different experience, a whole different motivation for participating.
Also, when you're dealing with it too, it's, you know, the word collaboration is so, it's so important. You look at today's economy, you got businesses, you got marketers, they're so budget crunched, and you have to do so much more with less time, because the economy in and of itself, it's slumping, and we don't really know where it's going to go. Consumers are spending less, so the big question is, you know, what's missing? What brings you back to the profitability that you should be getting in your business? You know, the questions they ask, is it external, is it internal? And I think really what they're missing is that think all community. They're missing that collaboration that it's going to take to get the job done. And I think that's really where it is.
I completely agree. I think, you know, as an extension of this idea that we now live in a global community and that we're connected in new ways, we need to realize that we need to work together to solve the problems that we kind of created on our own. And what I mean by that is, you know, the book is called We First as a counterpoint to the me first mentality that was out there for a long time. And, you know, we saw this in the way that Wall Street behaved. We even saw this in the way that consumers, you know, acted as customers. We saw it in the way that we treat the environment. So we're all guilty of it. But now we need to work together to provide the solutions we need at scale. And really, the connective tissue between us all, the thing that allows us to connect around what we care about and make a difference in the private sector, that actually is the role of social media. So it's still a very, very, very human issue we're talking about. It just happens to be that this technology is what's connecting us.
Oh, sure. Who was it? What was his name? Jeff Howe over at Wired Magazine. When they first started this phenomenon, they called it crowdsourcing. And I guess that's what they called it, and that created the online community that we have now. And that online community, Simon, it affected every phase and facet of business there is today. And I really believe in the long run, if you don't have your brand, if you don't know how to connect, your profit is going to dwindle away to almost nothing. So you have to stay abreast of what's going on. And I thought that the magic, the answer to the whole thing is you find a couple of 12-year-olds and you ask them how to run all the technical stuff, and then you'll stay in business.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You're kind of half joking and half not, in a sense, because it is really hard to keep up with the technology because it's changing so quickly, and it's changing more and more quickly all the time. But you know what's really important is something else you said. In the context of a fast-changing marketplace, you have to be your own compass, in which case you have to define your own brand. And as the marketplace is becoming more fragmented, there's more and more small companies popping up. There's more and more companies that are building their own communities online. You need to put your hand up and say, I am a brand, this is what I stand for, and message consistently about that. Because everybody is looking out over the horizon to see who they should buy from, who they should work with. And unless you have your hand up high, they won't see you. So in a sense, brands are becoming more human, but also more humans are becoming brands. And we need to look at these tools as, you know, real instruments that allow us to do that. So I think we ignore these new tools at our peril because we'll lose our customers.
No, sure. Well, when you're talking about branding, we bring something else up too, the value proposition. That's something that causes you to be different than everybody else. And I really believe today, if you ask 100 business people from all over the world, no matter where they are, what product it was that they were offering, selling, etc., and you said, you know, why are you different than your competition? You're not going to get a really good answer. They don't dig into it. They don't peel it away. You know, they don't even know what their competition looks like. And better yet, try defining what your ideal customer, your consumer is. And when you peel that down, if you can get down to 3 or 4 words or 5 words and you say, this is what my value proposition is, you got it. But most people don't have it. And it's the difference between what somebody hears and what somebody doesn't hear. And you could have the exact same product or service than the guy down the street. But if your potential customer, your target customer, hears it from you and doesn't hear it from the other guy, hears that value in it for them, then there's your branding and you move. So I really believe branding is so critical to someone's success today.
It is so critical. And I think there's a couple of exercises that your listeners do to just really sort of get some sort of read on where they're at. One of the most powerful demonstrations you can do of your branding or explorations is to, as you say, reach out to your employees at your company. Just create a simple questionnaire, an email or whatever, and ask all of them what your company stands for. And invariably, you will get many different answers. And if you're lucky, there'll be a theme or some consistency there. But if it's all over the map, you should take that as a lesson that that's the experience of your customers. Basically, you're broadcasting your schizophrenia to everyone. I'm this, I'm that, I'm this, I'm that, I'm a competitor, I'm this latest technology, I'm anything and everything you want me to be. The second thing that you can do as a brand is just look at your media plan, look at the marketing that you're doing, look at all the different expressions of your brand, put it up on a wall and see what they say. And you know, the real test for a brand is what I call the reverse elevator pitch, which is, You know, in Hollywood, they talk about that elevator pitch when you got a movie. You get in the elevator with some studio exec, and you've sold them three floors above, by the time you reach three floors above. The reverse elevator pitch is when you can get into an elevator as the CEO or some sort of executive at a company and ask someone what that company stands for, and they tell you exactly what you want the company to stand for back to you. So that's really the test, when you know that your messaging is distilled and defined and consistent and resonating with people. And you're so right. Branding is so critical in this marketplace. You have to be a story well told.
Well, by the way, and the story well told is very critical. There's two stories. There are two stories that have to be told. One is the individual, the company story, and that's the bonding process with the potential consumer out there. But there is another story, and the story is about the product, the service, the whatever it is, and how it ties, how the benefit of the product ties to the want and the desire of the potential customer, how it is the solution to the problem that the customer has out there, or not only what they're missing, what they don't know they're missing.
Right. It's absolutely true. And, you know, the way I think a business owner, whether they're a small or medium-sized business or a large brand, should think of it is, you know, you need to have the core brand proposition, its story, its values clearly defined as an umbrella for the brand. And then any product or service should be an expression of that. But it should be completely logical. When you look at that product or service, you should be able to say, oh, of course, that makes total sense. And, you know, to some people listening, it may seem overly touchy-feely or human to talk about business in such emotional terms. But this is more important than ever, not just because it's effective marketing, but because consumers out there are now overwhelmed with information. We have so much information on the web and from advertising and on our phones and at the, you know, gas station. Basically, we're in filter mode, and we're looking to filter out what we don't want to hear, and we're looking for what's meaningful to us. So these values propositions, these core values of a brand, are a way for you to connect emotionally with the brand so that you actually pay attention. So it's not about screaming the loudest. It's not about having starbursts on your advertising. It's not about, you know, what is the dominant media, television, print, or radio. You know, it really is about connecting emotionally with somebody, and that's why it's so important to know what you stand for and, you know, your values.
Okay, but standing, connecting emotionally with somebody is much broader, and you're aware of this, but it's much broader than just saying the words. To connect with somebody emotionally, you've got to have recognizable scenarios within your story. They have to connect with it, and once they connect with it, there's that quick shot of dopamine and that recognition from the feel-good center of the brain. Now they feel good about what they heard, so they're calling themselves to action. And I think one of the biggest problems that we have today, without the proper branding, without the proper message that goes out to the public, we don't like to be sold anymore. This is not the same world it was 15, 20 years ago. People do not like to be sold. We love to buy, though. And it is.
Right.
It's the emotion that's created within the context of the story where there is recognition of some kind of satisfaction.
Yes, and I think it even goes further in some cases. The consumers now, particularly the media-savvy ones, want to co-author the story that a brand tells. Whether it's,
yeah,
you know, Nike reaching out and asking people to talk about their experience with cancer when they're supporting Lance Armstrong's Live Strong Foundation, or whether it's Mountain Dew reaching out and asking people to choose and name the next flavor of their drink. You know, people want to participate in the shaping and storytelling of a brand, in which case they're connecting around values that they both share, the brand and the customer, and then they get satisfaction about engaging and being partners in this process. So, you know, looked at it through that lens, you can see your consumers as partners and brand ambassadors that talk to other people about your products and services. So it's actually pretty exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have to have, and you said, I'll state it a different way, the customer has got to be vested in whatever that offer is. And we live in a world today where if a business really wants to be successful, they look within. They collaborate within. They create that foundation that causes them to be successful. But part of that foundation where they make their decisions, that where their decisions come from, has got to do with the customer also. And you build your own customers. Then you go out and you get more. Too many people are out there. They're getting new customers. They're cutting their prices. They're doing all of these things that are just going to cause them to go out of business. Build on what you have and use that opportunity.
Right. It's a sort of obvious statement, but one that bears repeating. We're now in the relationship business. You know, for a long time, I think, you know, the presumption was that companies had the best interests of their customers at heart, and then we got sort of drunk on the power of media out there, and everyone was using media to distort messaging or to create false images about themselves and to, you know, really line their own pockets. And that's no longer tenable because, you know, 2008 and beyond has really exposed all of that, in which case we really want, you know, customers really want to see that a brand cares about them, and they want to see that they're investing in those relationships, and they want to see that people are listening to them. And if you do that, that customer will go for work, to work on your behalf, and that's a really exciting stage.
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. Simon, we're just about running out of time. Is there a website we can find you and the book?
The book can be found at wefirstbook.com, wefirstbook.com, or on Amazon. It's actually, you know, it's been on two New York Times bestseller lists for how-to and advice, and also on the business list. So I'm hoping that you'll really enjoy and get a lot out of it. So wefirstbook.com. And you can also follow my blog, simonmainwaring.com, or follow me on Twitter at simonmainwaring. And you know, thank you for, you know, taking the time to talk with me today. And I really hope that people use the book We First, as a tool through which they can build their business, but also have a positive impact in the world. And I think that's really fulfilling.
Wonderful. Hey, Simon, it's been great having you on. I want to thank you so much for being here. And I got the book in my hands. This is a keeper.
All right, fantastic. Well, thank you so much.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
And what me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if for you now, some of these days.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. We're going to have some fun now. Lisa Custard with us. We're going to talk about kids. We're going to talk about bullies beating up on kids. Now, she manages her son's teen rock band Over Gravity, as well as being a hypnotherapist and an entertainer. And let us say, Lisa, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi. Wow, I'm just so excited to be speaking with you.
Oh, and thank
I'm
you
really,
so much.
Really excited. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to get this great message out.
Great. Well, let me ask you a question, and especially with what you do, if you're a hypnotherapist and you're an entertainer, especially the hypnotherapist part, you're going to take a little bit of a different look on why people bully people. Now, as a hypnotherapist, where was it that you got your training?
Board certified out here in Orange County, and I actually did 2 years, training underneath a couple of doctors, and you know, I actually worked closely with a couple professors, Mind over matter, Harvard. So it's all mental.
Oh, I hear
it's
you.
Amazing, the power of the mind. It's mind-boggling.
No, oh, absolutely. The power of the mind. You should get a T-shirt. The power of the mind is mind-boggling. I love every second of that one. Now, by the way, let's go to teens and people bullying teens. What was it that caused you to take a look at this and get interested in the subject in the first place?
Well, I was just so disturbed by the fact that it's not, I mean, I had heard in the past of children, you know, bullying other children, but I had no idea until it personally happened to my son that an adult would actually bully a child online. That was just like, wow. Wow.
Yeah, but what did they do? What, you know, when you talk about an adult to a child, an example, what is it that adult, the one we're talking about now, what did that adult do? And that way we can define what bullying is so we can all see it.
Okay. There was actually I'll just come out right out and say it. There was actually they called it a dislike party.
Huh.
And yeah, there was actually a dislike party on Facebook. Like, an adult organized a dislike party. You know, it's like to get other people to dislike, you know, the band. It was just like, wow. And then it went beyond that, because at first I thought I had talked with this person's child because the child had created a fake Facebook page, you know, using a fictitious name and said, you know, bad things about the band or whatever. And I found, you know, who was responsible, and I actually talked with the parent, and it seems like, okay, oh, I'm so sorry, and blah, 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 and, you know, I really bought into it because I try to really, you know, be open with people and just, you know, give them the benefit of the doubt, but then it came to my attention that the root of this was actually the parent.
Hmm.
I can't really hold a child accountable if the parent is the one who's the driving force behind the bullying. And this was like an eye-opener for me. So for me, the actual root of bullying is actually the adult bullies.
But what would cause that parent to do that? And when I say what would cause them to do it, it's very hard even to hear that,
isn't it so
absolutely. And I'm glad you're bringing the issue to the forefront, and I think it's critically important. But did you get behind it? What caused that person to do that in the first place?
Well, you know, we're in Hollywood out here, and I guess, you know, competition is, you know, pretty stiff. But even though, you know, some people have that attitude where, you know, competition is really stiff, it's dog-eat-dog and all of that, I feel like if you're persistent and if you're working hard, things will happen. And that's really what's been happening for the band. And it goes back to just like a jealousy thing. You know, if someone's doing something and the other person's not doing it, then they want to attack. And instead of that driving them to work harder on, you know, their perspective field. You know, it's kind of goes back to the crab syndrome where you could actually boil a whole bunch of crabs or whatever, like in a pot with no lid, because the one crab tries to get out of the pot of boiling water and the other crabs will pull them back down. You know, it's like kind of like a weird thing.
No,
I'm from the South, so I know all about boiling crabs.
Let me tell you what my biggest concern with this is, and I think it's a major concern. Yeah. Bullying is one thing. When I was a kid 100 years ago, the bully would chase you home. Maybe you get smacked in the nose. It was over with. They left you alone. This is a whole different world today. And my biggest concern with the parent bullying, that child that can get bullied may not have it emotionally together. They're not, may not be grounded in such a way that an adult is. I mean, some adults also not grounded either. But the point of contention is it could cost someone their life. That's really where
the problem is. And that's, oh my gosh, I'm so happy that you brought that up, you know, because like with my son, I mean, when things happen, I mean, he's the type of kid that things just, it just rolls off of him. He knows he's loved. He knows who he is. But like you said, if it was another child who had low self-esteem to start with, I mean, something like that could really go to their heart and they could actually believe, you know, the lies that are said. And there's been children that have taken these things to heart and, like you said, have committed suicide. I mean, there was a story about an adult woman that just took it upon herself online to attack this young little girl.
I remember.
And it wasn't even like her daughter went to school with this girl and it was a cheerleader rivalry or anything. It was just like just singled her out, a beautiful child who actually took her life.
You know, what I don't understand, Lisa, is where, and I'm going to use a word here. It's a very strong word. I don't understand where this hate comes from, because it was a year or two ago there were these kids that, you know, caused somebody to take their life. But even outside of the memorial services, standing across the street from this kid's house who was already dead, they were still doing their stuff. And I don't understand for the life of me what would drive somebody to be so contemptuous to begin with to be responsible for someone's death, but then take it the step farther after they're dead to continue on.
Well, obviously, you know, there are some real issues there that need therapy. And, you know, there's a lot of things that, you know, that are below the surface that we're not seeing, you know. Because I'm not saying that all children that have parents that are bullies and some parents are abusive to children, just because you have an abusive parent that says that you're going to be an abusive, you know, parent as well as a cycle that keeps going on. You can choose to break that cycle. Sadly, as a child, I mean, I actually had an abusive parent. But I made a conscious decision that I would be so ever so loving if I was blessed enough to have a child one day.
Yeah.
You know, and that I would stand up for that child. I totally remember as a second grader walking home from school one day, and there was like I'm in the second grade, and there's like a seventh grader who's way bigger than me at that time. In second grade, you're awfully tiny. And this little girl just had, and I still remember it today, she had a leather brown book bag filled with books, and she just beat me down with her book bag, you know? And, I mean, I went home, and, you know, in tears, obviously. And my mom was the type of person where it's just like, you pray for her, you know, and it never was addressed, you know, she never went to my defense like, hey, you shouldn't do this, you know, to someone's child. The girl's mother never was talked to. Her behavior escalated till she actually, you know, problems with jail, whatever, you know, it's a pattern. If you don't get this while they're young, you know, they will, you know, be problems in society. But if you can get them while they're young, they have a chance.
Yeah. No question about it. And it's what you learn, what you model from. And the world today is getting very dangerous. And I don't even like saying
it
that. But, you know, you go back some years ago.
It's true, though. It really is. I would assure you, my son is homeschooled.
It was safe to walk down the street. You know, you send your kids out to trick-or-treat, and you send them out alone. They came back with the candy, and you weren't worried about the candy. I mean, this is way back. But we live in a world today that is very dangerous out there, and I'm glad there's people like yourself, Lisa, who are bringing this information out for people to see, to experience, because it happens, and people die from the end result. That doesn't mean that everybody that gets cyberbullied is going to end up, you know, dead. But the point is, there are some people, and one is way too many.
There are. And you know, two is too many in my account. If someone's child loses their life over, you know, some hurtful word, you know, it's just, But children, they're at that age where they absorb, you know. And if they have a person in authority as an adult that are actually being that negative influence to them, it could like really affect them for the rest of their lives.
Oh, sure. No,
really,
there's no
serious
question about it.
And one more thing. I find it disheartening. Some of the people that I've talked with on the subject or whatever, were if the bully happens to be a 12-year-old girl, you know, with pigtails, you know, it's laughable. Ha, 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 ha. It's funny.
Yeah.
But it's not.
And the problem is it's not funny. Lisa, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. A couple of things. The first thing is, are you doing anything with organizations? Have you got something, you're blogging? What is it that you're doing to get other people involved to be able to stop some of this stuff?
Well, the name of the rock band that my son has, it's called Over Gravity. And literally it means that gravity pulls you down. So Over Gravity is up, 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 up. And we're going to be starting a campaign where we're going to be gathering stories of children that have been bullied and cyberbullied, and we're going to make all those stories available to really just shine a spotlight on what's happening and saying that this is not acceptable.
That's great. Now, do you have a website where we can find you at? And if anybody wants to contribute, join in, where can we do so?
Okay, well, the kids, if you want to, what I would really, really appreciate at this point, because I, like I said, I am going to be working with some different sponsors. You know, we have Daisy Rock Guitars, and we have that. But right now, what we really need is if everyone could head on down to Over Gravity's Facebook page and give the band a like. If they have any stories that they have that they could personally share with me, of bullying experiences, please contact me, and I will get that out to the public. I'm collecting stories and everything right now.
Wonderful. Hey, Lisa, it's www.overgravity.com.
That is correct.
Wonderful. Hey, listen, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And the kids, thank you. I really appreciate you. And I heard you were in Alaska. That's where I want to retire one day. It's beautiful out there.
Wonderful place to
sit under the aurora borealis.
Yeah, and if anybody bullies anybody, you throw them outside and the bears get them. Good night.
That's funny.
Good night.
I'm gonna wait. You're gonna feel lonely. And what me only. Cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, said some of these days I do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby. For you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Susan Marshall back with us. How to Grow a Backbone. That's the book, 10 Strategic Gaining, 10 Strategies. I wonder if we can add that in the subtitle. 10 Strategies for Gaining Power and Influence at Work. And we're going to talk about something called a leader. What is that?
Hi, Michael Ray.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Okay, what is a leader?
Are you cooking in our sultry weather?
Oh, yeah. You know what? I haven't been able to go out in the sultry weather, and I've had to paint myself instead of getting a tan.
Oh, well, there you go. You know what? Yeah. You're very fortunate, and I'm going to say this, and you'll see why it will feed into our conversation this evening. I can't believe I have a dog, as you know, and I've walked her every single day in this very, very difficult warm weather, and people will roll their windows down, don't know them, haven't seen them, and they'll say, "Lady, are you crazy? It's hot outside. You're going to kill your dog." And I
think, you know what my response to them would have been? "I'll leave the dog inside. You come and clean up the mess."
Oh, I laugh. My dog loves, she doesn't know it's hot.
Yeah.
The breeze has been fine. It's been very, very manageable. But what blows my mind, and we'll bring this into the context of leaders and how conversations create change, right? Last week we talked about change. People are convincing themselves that at a certain temperature, either too hot or too cold, going outside is going to be detrimental.
Sure.
We say things long enough to ourselves, we convince ourselves there, and this is how backbones erode, never get started, are, you know, discouraged from growing. It just blows my mind. So let's talk about leaders. Who's a leader?
What is a leader? What is a leader?
A leader is someone who influences conversations, influences ideas, and makes change. And in a very real way, when we watch leaders, we understand, we realize that leaders teach us how the world works. And because they have that ability just by virtue of their position as leaders, and I want to spend a little time on the position thing, they sometimes convince us that what we believe from them regarding how the world works is true, when oftentimes it is not. We see it every day. We hear it every single day we listen to our politicians. So let's look at who is a leader. Well, moms and dads are leaders, right? They lead
Absolutely.
The family. They teach kids how the world works, how their family works. And we grow up believing that how our family works is how every family on the planet works. And it's sometimes very difficult to realize later that's not true. Business and community leaders, obviously, are leaders. Ministers and educators. Very, very important leaders, very powerful leaders. When they can point to dogma or doctrine or things that have been proven true way before we ever, you know, ever saw life on the planet. Doctors, lawyers, financial advisors, fitness gurus. And when you think about people who influence our thinking or who show us the way the world works, the gossip at the water cooler is a leader.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm in agreement. I'm listening.
Yeah. Okay. So when we think about the kinds of conversations that we're subjected to, I want to talk about healthy conversations or conversations within healthy cultures and within unhealthy cultures. Then I want to bring it back to the what we were talking about last week, this formula for change, and how people can use this information to make changes that they want to make in their own lives. First, let's talk about conversations within unhealthy cultures. And by a culture, we can be talking about something as small as a family or even a relationship, because a relationship has its own culture. Or we can be talking in broader terms like a business or a school, even a community. So when we think about unhealthy conversations within unhealthy cultures, we hear things like, who's doing what to whom, right? Did you know that he did and he said and she did and she said?
I think we call
it gossip. Who messed up. And who's going to get the blame for something that didn't turn out the way everybody is expecting it would? We hear about who's being favored or protected, or the flip side of that, who's being discriminated against. We hear about unfair policies, broken systems, lousy equipment, inept coworkers. Gee, do we hear that? Inept partners, politicians who don't know what the heck they're talking about, nasty customers, and generally speaking, what's wrong with this place? Have you heard any of those things lately?
All the time.
All the time.
Yeah.
And when you think about our society, these conversations are happening 24/7. Every time we overhear somebody at work, when we listen to people fighting with each other in their families, when we turn on the television, when we turn on the radio, when we go to the internet, it's all this kind of stuff. And when we look at the who's doing what to whom and who messed up, that's entertainment today. Is it any reason we find ourselves unhealthy, unconfident, if that's a word, you know, not confident, and really struggling to figure out who the heck we are and what we want to do, and oh, by the way, how are we going to do that? So backbones, as I said earlier, get eroded, sometimes never have a chance to grow.
Sure.
And leaders, be they the stronger partner in a relationship, the gossip at the water cooler, someone in a position of leadership, have the opportunity not only to influence these kinds of conversations, but to change them. Right? So if you think about a conversation you might have with yourself that's unhealthy, it's like, geez, you know, how did I mess that up? What did I do that was wrong? Why is somebody picking on me? You know, why is that person being favored and I'm not? Why are the rich getting everything and I'm, you know, struggling to find an Xbox game?
Susan, let me hold you up, because that what you just said is really the reason that they talk at the water coolers. They, you know, that all of the complaints and the rest of it, it happens to fall into projection. You know, and
yes,
we can change conversation, we can change mindsets and the rest of it, but pessimism and the rest of it, when it really comes down to it, it has usually nothing to do with the people they're talking about. It's to do with them, and what they're doing is they're projecting their own garbage because they won't see it in themselves, and they say, oh, it's your fault, it's her fault, it's their fault.
Yep, that's right.
And say it was his fault.
And yeah, and we live in a culture, in a society that enables and supports and says, by virtue of not intervening and changing the conversation, that that's okay. And so, therefore, all people who participate in these kinds of things, and we all do, you know, from time to time, nobody's immune to it, but we are saying that, you know what, in fact, that's the way the world works. These unhealthy conversations are absolutely steeped in pessimism. And what's very interesting to me is, as you listen, they're fueled and driven by assumptions. We are assuming, based on what we saw or heard, that someone is being favored or protected. We don't know that to be fact. We make the assumption, and then we act as if that's reality. Happens, as you said, all the time.
Sure.
So if we go to the other side of the table and say, okay, well, if that's unhealthy, and we can agree that, you know, it is reality, and it's not helpful, and it erodes people's confidence, how do we as individuals, how do people as leaders change those conversations? Well, if you start paying attention to conversations within healthy relationships, within healthy families, healthy businesses, schools, and communities, you'll hear them talk about things like what their members or their customers are interested in. In a healthy relationship, if you and I are in a relationship, I will be curious about what interests you. What are you thinking about now? What are you working on now? Rather than, you know, how come you didn't respond in 30 seconds to my text message? Why are you dissing me? As a simple relationship example. We'll hear people talk about new ideas, new systems, new products. We'll hear people talking about taking great ideas they found somewhere else and bringing them into this particular relationship or community or business. So we're learning from other people. We're observing the world not necessarily to judge it as unhealthy, you know, conversations do, but to learn from it. I'm curious about that rather than how come that's happening. So we're not judging, we're learning.
Can I give you a little bit of a shift in perspective on this?
Sure, yeah.
Sure. The shift is this. It's a shift in purpose. You know, if your purpose is to prove yourself right about yourself, and if you think you're a loser and you think you're a failure, you're going to be doing all the things that you just talked about. There's people that you won't forgive because they did something. Okay. But if your purpose shifts, when you begin to learn, as you're talking about, listen to the other side of the message, quote unquote, when your purpose shifts, so does your mentality. And so do the things that you're moving towards and the goals that you want to accomplish. That shifts also. So effectively, it's called if you sit down with yourself and say, what's your purpose here? And if it'll come out, and if you do the shift, then all of a sudden, let's say somebody that you just can't forgive for something, and you have a certain purpose in life, whatever that is. And not the overall purpose, but the purpose to beat yourself up.
Right.
If you shift your purpose and you start to feel better about yourself, what they did doesn't matter because it is not within the realm of what you deem to be what you emphasize, what's important to you. So I really believe it's a shift in purpose, which brings you a completely different shift in mindset, which gives you a whole new outlook in the world that you're in.
That's absolutely correct. And the challenge here is to get people to start that journey, and it truly is a journey of shifting the purpose. Because we are surrounded by the toxicity of these unhealthy conversations and the pessimism and the assumptions, it's easy. We've talked, I think, a number of times about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? The belonging need is very, very strong. And when you are determined to understand your particular purpose, that's self-actualization way at the top of his ladder. Very few people ever get there, and we are seeing more and more people stuck in trying to satisfy this belonging need by being members of gangs, by being unhappy, by being in the, you know, the poor pity communities of the class envy that is coming from the highest levels in Washington is an example of this. And so helping people understand their purpose is a very, very challenging, sometimes long-term deal. But the more we can help them get curious about what's possible, the more we can help them understand what they've been gifted with, whether it's looks, whether it's talent, whether it's the inability to sing, whatever that is, and to focus them on developing their capacity toward a purpose. That's how we begin to change not only conversations in people's lives, but entire cultures. I love what you said, and in fact, I was talking with a woman earlier in the week. She had been through, you know, a breakup of a relationship, and for 2 years had been sort of in this low-grade mourning. And as we see so many, many times, we're trying to say, well, it's over, but it's not really over. You know, he's just in a bad way. He's going to come back. You know, he never had anything like the two of us shared, blah, blah, blah. 2 years. And when she finally reconciled herself to the fact that this relationship was over, she got back to her work.
Yeah.
And as I said, talked with her earlier, she is full of energy again. She's back to who she was several years ago. And it's amazing that type of process, she had rediscovered her purpose.
Yeah.
Or said another way, she had for the time that she was in this relationship. Well, she had, while she was in this relationship, convinced herself that her purpose was to be a perfect partner in the relationship. Well, that's not a big enough purpose for anybody. But that's, and, you know, we see young people particularly getting caught in that particular trap. It's a wonderful thing, and it's a wonderful means of growing and learning and, you know, developing relationship stuff is all healthy, good stuff. But it's not a big enough purpose.
Yeah.
And she had gotten stuck. But she went back. She is now thriving. She's doing fabulous work again. And the juxtaposition is mind-blowing to me because I think a lot of people are lost for that reason. And I think you hit the point, the purpose. What is my purpose?
Yeah, no, absolutely, no question. Yeah, and usually the purpose, and we're not talking about life's purpose, but
right.
it's your purpose for living, your purpose for being when you get up in the morning, you know, the purpose for going to bed at night and smiling when you go to bed. And
yep.
I think the major problem with most of it is what that word reality is. You know, you mentioned
yep.
assumption before. When you take assumption on as reality, an assumption can be an incontestable conclusion, which causes
yep.
you to think that it's fact. And if you think that it's fact, then you live your life based on assumption, which is non-reality. You know, you've
right.
lived all your life and people have told you that a tree is a certain thing. You've never seen a tree. And one day you walk outside and you walk into the tree and you go, oh, this is a tree. And that's really
yeah.
what it's about. Yeah.
And yes, and the implications of that for various cultures who've never seen a tree, or, you know, inner city kids
sure.
who've never seen a cow. Big stuff. And just staying with that, you know, assumptions and pessimism, the flip side of that, when we start thinking about healthy cultures and healthy relationships, the conversations tend to be forward-looking. They're not stuck in the here and now, or they're not mired in the past. They're looking at what's next, what's possible. They tend to be, generally speaking, optimistic versus pessimistic, and they are fueled or driven by data and evidence.
Sure.
So you'll often hear people in these kinds of conversations, if somebody makes a statement, the sky is green, the person in a healthy conversation will say, really, based on what? Tell me why. What evidence do you have to say the sky is green? It's a bad example because it's still subjective and colorblind. People don't know green from red, but
well,
to get the point.
Wait. We don't like them anyway. Go ahead.
Really? You're making an assumption?
I'm doing the gossip. No, I'm doing the water cooler gossip. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, and again, it's the things that we start thinking about when we are looking at creating change and the competence, confidence, risk-taking elements of backbone. We're looking for opportunities born of change rather than looking at change and being scared by it. We're looking at what is changing in the external environment that may open up a new chance for us to do things that
sure.
we weren't able to do before. And this is one, that particular mindset for people who are jobless or who have been jobless is one of the most challenging to get over. Because they look at change in the environment rather than many. The generalizations are always dangerous. We talk about this a lot. But if I've been unemployed, and the longer I've been unemployed, the more change I see in the environment, the more pessimistic I tend to be. Because I'm understanding less and less of what's happening, feeling less and less competent to be able to do something, to take a risk on my behalf. And
well,
so
well,
the competence, confidence...
Mm-hmm. You hit something, and I want to make sure that we get the point across because I think it's critically important. Go back to the woman that you were talking about with the relationship, etc. See, it didn't have to be a relationship between a man and a woman. It could have been a relationship mm-hmm. between you and your dog, you and your business, you and your something. The world is built on relationship, and it's
yes.
the definition of the relationship that causes you to act or not act in a certain way. So a relationship in and of itself, you have a relationship to everything on this planet, in your life, the air you breathe, and it starts out with the relationship that you have with yourself. If you get that rock solid, then the relationship can be the same with everybody around you. If you do not know how to love, you can't love anybody. If you don't know how to be happy, you can't be happy with anybody. You cannot give anybody something that you don't have yourself. So in
That's
essence,
right.
really it's about relationship. And then once you create the relationship with yourself, you define what the purpose is. And it doesn't have to be in words. You can feel what it is. You define
right.
what that purpose is. You begin to take a shift. So the circumstances are exactly the same, but the outcomes are different.
And I think a very important aspect of what you're saying is that at some point there needs to be a challenge to the assumption of self. And a perfect story that's happening right now in my own life, my daughter, after not seeing her father for 9 years, has been asked to go see him because he's had a second heart attack. She is struggling with bad memories, with very, very difficult relationship between she and her dad, and is now telling herself out loud, but now I am a grown woman. I'm a successful, you know, wife. I've got a beautiful family. She is literally convincing herself that the picture she sees of herself today is, in fact, very different than the picture she saw herself in relationship with her dad. But it's
wobbly. Let me hold you up. This is critical. We have to go, but this is an extremely important point. Let's break this down just for a moment, okay? The reason she's upset with her dad, and I can hear this, she cried out for help and he wasn't there. Is that true?
Yes.
I don't mean she literally said, help me, but
right.
love me.
Right.
You know, I'm your daughter. She said, help, and he didn't pay attention to her, right? What's he doing
now? Worse than that, told her she was not worth paying attention to.
But she cried out for help as an
yes.
individual and, an ad- and
yes.
as a daughter, and he
yes.
shut her down. What's
yes.
he doing right now? He's crying out to her for help. And if she turns
yes.
him down, she's doing what he did.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. That's what I heard.
And, yeah, very, very important. And yet is still struggling with that little girl she was.
Yeah.
And having to reframe and challenge those assumptions.
And if she doesn't, listen to this. If she doesn't go get beyond that, then he was right.
Yes. yes.
You got
Fascinating
it.
Fascinating stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
All backbone material.
Absolutely. Tell her to get some backbone. Go beat him up.
Well, she's coming here before she goes there, so we'll have an opportunity okay. to solidify her backbone before she goes.
I love every second of it. Okay, we're about out of time. Website we can find you at?
www.executiveadvisorllc.com.
Good. I'm going to sit right here, and I'm going to wait until you come back.
Please don't melt.
I won't.
Have a good night, Michael Ray.
Okay, good night.
Bye-bye.
For you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime and a hand to hold when leaves begin to
fall.
And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. I got my special box here that got here about 15 minutes ago, and my entire world is built around what I have in this box. Dr. Mayor Eisenstein is with us, and he is the CEO of Home First Natural Pharmaceuticals, and we're going to do our Medical Watch segment. Hey, Mayor. Hi. Welcome back.
Hey, Michael. Welcome. Absolutely welcome. I was listening to the discussion. It was very, very fascinating. You know,
yes.
The one you had just before.
Yes. No, absolutely.
You know, it really just goes down to the whole breakdown of the family today, you know, and that's, you know, it's really depressing because no family is spared that, you know, and it's become permissible to break down the family. I mean, that's, and I'm going to say something that may sound radical to lots of people, but I think it really becomes, when this country legalized abortion on demand, I think that was the beginning of the breakdown of the family, because I'm not taking a religious position on that. I'm looking at it from a, if you are able to destroy the weakest element in our society, everything follows from that. Doesn't make any difference. You know, fathers not taking, doing their job, mothers not doing their jobs, parents getting divorced, you know, it just, and I'm not saying there's not any reason for it, but it's hard to imagine that we have a society where being divorced now is the norm and not being divorced is the not norm.
Sure. 55% plus divorce in the first year. And I think one of the biggest problems that we're not aware of, and I think it happens, and part of it came out in the last last half hour of the last interview. And if you listen to it, what we found was the very thing that the girl was upset about her father with in the relationship back and forth, she was going to do the same thing to him. We don't realize
right.
that.
I thought that was very, very wise what you brought out, you know, that who will be the bigger person, you know, I mean, you know, and as her father's getting older, all of a sudden it shifts that she's now the adult and he's the younger person in a sense, you know. And I thought what you said was absolutely brilliant, you know. We have kind of a similar situation because my oldest daughter is divorced and her husband, who we've known since he's 12 years old, her ex-husband, and just fell apart. So, you know, and she's really done a good job not to make any issue with the three children. But the oldest daughter, who just turned 16, never really had a good relationship with her father. And he never, nothing bad. He just wasn't, you said it so well, he wasn't there. He just didn't. And she decided last week she wanted to go and visit him. He lives in Arizona. She said she's been very entrenched in this TV series, 16 and Pregnant. And she said the one unifying factor in every family that she saw, there was no relationship with the young girl and her father. And so not that she's looking to get pregnant, but she said, I have to make sure there's a relationship no matter what, you know. So she went to Arizona and you know, they had a good time, you know, and very proud of her. Pretty wise for 16 years old to put that together.
Sure. I mean, no question about it. And I really believe if we stop, see, we've gotten to a culture of today, Mayor, and I don't even like to say this, you know, I'm old school. You know, if I got out of line, my mom would give me a whack in the rear end. If I got in trouble in school, I faced the paddle, you know, and it didn't destroy me emotionally. It didn't put me into any kind of a depressive mood for whatever. It's what it was. We had something called consequence. Today, today, if you whack your child in the rear end at night when you get up in the morning and go to breakfast, you've got their attorney sitting at your breakfast table.
There's no consequence. All you have to do today is say, I'm sorry, and everything goes away.
Somehow yeah, it's not.
That doesn't cut it.
No, and the other side of that is that I think what we're going to see within the next year or two is when you see high school football, everybody's going to run the same way. Because we wouldn't want anybody to feel bad if they lost the game.
And let me tell you something, how I tie this in, what I want to talk about this evening. Many of your listeners have watched Rupert Murdoch, and I think his son is James Murdoch, testifying.
Sure.
You know, and the one thing that I really liked about it is how kind and protective the son was for his father. That impressed me to no end. Now, these are evil people. No one should. Murdoch is in the same category as George Soros. He wants to bring the United States down. He just hates the United States to no end. You know, but I tell you where it ties in. So they went after James Murdoch, who essentially now the head of the his whole corporation, the Murdoch Corporation, went and vilified Dr. Andrew Wakefield. When he came out with his paper about 15 years ago that there may be a link between measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine and autism. And what he did was he allowed his newspapers to, he brought in goon squads who just vilified him. And he then also got them essentially backhandedly to have his license take away to practice medicine. Now, first of all, Dr. Wakefield never said measles, mumps, rubella vaccine causes autism. He said there may be a link based on the cases that he saw and the evidence that he presented. But now it comes out. James Murdoch owns 30% of Glaxo's KlineSmith. They're the makers of the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. And they saw already that Dr. Wakefield's work caused people to start looking and seeing, is there danger in these vaccines? You know, so it's very fascinating, you know. Is that incredible?
Is that incredible?
No, absolutely incredible.
And frightening. But now, a couple days ago, Dr. Helen Radzik, Dr. Radzik is a retired professor of pharmacology who worked for one of the major pharmaceutical industry, and she just did a scientific review of vaccines and autism, and she came up with another. There's no question about it that vaccines cause autism, or they cause brain damage, whatever you want to call it. It's no different than denying that getting hit in the head playing football or boxing will not cause you to have brain damage as time goes on. I mean, it just, your grandmother and my grandmother knew that, but she came up with something a little bit different, which all fits in together also, and that is, starting in the middle 1990s, early 1990s, they decided they better start making vaccines not from animal tissue, because before they were making on chicken embryos, they were growing the vaccine on monkey kidney. They decided that they would do it with human tissue to avoid all the viruses that were contained in human tissue. So they started growing it on the cells of aborted fetuses. Let's leave out any of the moral or ethical arguments about this. What she said was that that was the beginning. Now you have DNA, human DNA, which can easily infiltrate the person that it's given to. And this is found in the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. It's found in the hepatitis A vaccine. It's found in the chickenpox vaccine. Really, really frightening. You know, and I think she's come up with a theory that's even more sound than the mercury, the aluminum, which are all damaging. You know, but here's the more frightening part. Dr. Brian Strome from the University of Pennsylvania was one of the members who served on the Institute of Medicine panel, which said that vaccines are totally safe and don't cause any brain damage. When he was interviewed by CBS correspondent Cheryl Atkinson and asked about this, he said he didn't even know that these vaccines contained human tissue. How embarrassing is that? I've known that. I'm no bridging. I've known this for 15 years. You know, isn't that frightening?
Yeah, wait, but how much money are you making from it? You heard what I just said.
Oh, my God. I am making millions of dollars in the sale of my book. I had a $1 billion advance.
I really hate to say it, but it really is, and it sounds so cliche, but it's called follow the money. You follow the money, you're going to get your answers.
And let me tell you, for all those people who don't believe that Rupert Murdoch hates the United States, News Corp was the largest donor to the Obama presidential campaign in 2008.
Yeah, no, got it. No question. Yeah, no question.
Frightening stuff. Frightening stuff. You know, I mean, and I don't. I think the stuff that's going on now about the debt ceiling, that's all nonsense. The goal of the president and the left-wing administration is to destroy this country. Whatever they can do to destroy this country, and it's the most frightening thing in the world. You know, I mean, I just pray that the American people wake up and realize that, you know, we have to all become like Texas, a right-to-work state. And I've got my trouble with Governor Perry because he's got his own issues. I mean, when it comes to the right-to-work, my God, Texas created about 30 to 40% of all new jobs in the last 2 years.
Have you ever really taken a good look at Sarah Palin? I don't mean physically.
wait, just be careful what you say.
Yeah, I know. Okay. But
you may not be on the air tomorrow.
I know. That's good. The rays are coming down. I can see them coming through the bushes.
Yeah.
But I interviewed Sarah Palin when she was, I was in Fairbanks, and when she was running for the first time, when she was running for governor of the state of Alaska. And I listened very closely to her, And I loved everything that she had to say. When that woman was in office, when she finally got in office, the first thing she did was she went against the party, the Republican Party. She went against the oil companies. She caused people to get more money. There is something called a permanent fund dividend, and it's they take the average of 5 years of the oil profits, and they average that out, and then a percentage of that is distributed to the population of Alaska. And it could be anywhere from, you could get anywhere from $800 to $1,200, $1,300 per person in a family. And it increased when she was there. And all she did was work for the people of Alaska. I saw it. I watched it. It was right there. And I would love to see somebody like that, that's not a politician, but more of a statesman, get into office and do something that isn't being done right now. This is ridiculous. Forget Obama or anybody else. It's just stupid.
Oh, I tell you what, I'd like to see President Herman Cain. You know, can you think of anywhere? About a real story. Here's someone who came from poverty to lead a billion-dollar company, you know, in Godfather Pizza. I mean, how impressive is that? You know,
we need a businessman. Yeah, no, that's it.
We need a businessman.
Or a business person. We need somebody.
Or a business person, a businesswoman. That's right. You know, that's, you know. But the trouble is, the way the political aspects go, it's very difficult because you got media that digs up every little bit of something. And so No one in business is going to subject himself to that scrutiny. The only ones could subject themselves to scrutiny to run for public office are people who've done nothing. I mean, those people can run for office, like Obama, you know, because he has nothing to hide because he's done nothing, you know. And it kind of reminds me now of, in medicine, I'm applying to the state of Florida to get a license. Eventually, I want to move to Florida. Well, it's been 6 months of asking me for one thing after the other. They asked me about a course I took 40 years ago, and I didn't get an A in it. Why?
Yeah, no, by the way, some of the ridiculous things that are going on. Have you seen some of the money that has been spent on ridiculous things? I'm going to give you something that it's not hearsay and it's provable. And I don't know the exact amount, but it was within a couple $100,000. There was a research for the size of a homosexual's penis. I mean, this is the kind of money that's being spent by the government in some of the most ridiculous areas that you can ever imagine. Now, why they would want to know that, I have no idea. But the point was, there was money dedicated to that, Mayor. And we worry about guys, kids coming back from the service. You know, they've been in Afghanistan. They've been all over the place. And they come back, they put their life on the line. Some of them come back and they've been damaged and forever, and they're getting their houses taken away. They don't have jobs. Some of them end up homeless. Some of them don't get the full benefit of medical. I don't get that. And we're giving billions of dollars to places like, to drill oil offshore. Venezuela. To drill offshore, we're going to be there. We're going to be their customers. See, something's wrong here. There is a movement afoot. Soros, I'm sure, is behind it. But there is a movement afoot right now to totally destroy the economy. You destroy the economy and you replace it with another economy based on what they want. You destroy all of it. And when you destroy all of it, what you have are people who will be led around by the nose, because if you scare me enough, I'm going to do what you want me to do, and I'll go get a brown shirt. Okay, I'm off my rampage.
No, let me tell you something very scary, but I can tell you something. You know, this is still the greatest country in the world, and we're fighting back. There's a little bit of fighting back in the political election of 2010, and I have great faith that, you know, push comes to shove, it'll be the end of these acorns and all these fraudulent organizations, you know. And that's why Herman Cain, even though I don't think he has a chance to be president, because he just he speaks his mind, you know. But I would say that if Americans really thought about it, more than 50% of Americans think that what he's saying is more right than anything else.
Yeah, no, I got you loud and clear. We're out of time, so how about a website we can find you at?
HomeFirst.com, that's HomeFirst.com, HomeFirst.com. And if you want to, I've got a great thing on our piece on on vaccines, on testimony. You see, if you hit health news, and you just you'll see the Canary Party in Massachusetts pursues vaccine exemption rights. It's a wonderful few minute video talking about some of the people who have testified as to how their children have been damaged by vaccines.
Okay, and very, very quickly, before we go, we're not talking to Radio Susie anymore. The box I opened when you first came on was my Pro-C, my Bitonade, my Omega-3, my CoQH, my Pro-DH, and my multivitamin for men. We're not talking to her. She grabbed half my vitamin C.
Oh, well, we have to send you some more.
Okay.
We have an unlimited supply. Thank you, my dear friend.
Thank you, friend.
Good night.
Next week.
Fabulous places we're longing to see.
Hi there.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Rise Merson with us. He's a world-renowned psychic medium, a trance channel, and a spiritual teacher with an uncanny ability to deliver messages from the other side. Originally from India and New York City, now in Los Angeles, he's a resident there. His heartfelt demeanor attracts people from all walks of life, and he connects people with their spirit guides, whom he says stand with every human being. They're loving, they're wise, and they're often humorous. His devoted following of loyal clients span from the continent and are touched by his insightful messages of the truth. He is the co-author of Red Eagle Speaks, a book of wisdom. Rise, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey there, how are you? Nice to be here. And pronounce Riz.
Riz, I'm sorry, can I do the whole thing over again?
Oh, that's fine.
I got a Riz. Okay.
I like the meaning behind the word rise because, you know, it's uplifting.
Absolutely, and it brings you there. Let me ask you this. When it really comes down to it, when we talk about channeling and we talk about spirits, where does a person like yourself get that special gift? Are you born with it? Does it happen? Or can anybody else have it?
I have a couple of things I want to say about this. I know and believe really in my heart that everyone has some, if you want to call it psychic or you want to call it intuitive sense. For me, they're very similar words. We can talk about the differences all day long. But the point is being able to have a sixth sense, a feeling that either something is going to happen a particular way, or even something as simple as you knew that person was going to call whom you haven't seen or heard from in so long, or you were just thinking of something or thinking of that person and they call you. It's an interesting word, the word channel, because most people use the word channel like turn the channel on the television set. But there's something in that example that actually is very accurate. So when we're watching TV or wherever we're sitting, you're in the studio and I'm here at home right now. Right now, wherever the listeners are, there are thousands of frequencies, radio and television frequencies flying over their roof or over their heads right now. And these are invisible frequencies, obviously. You can't see them. You can't hear them. You can't even feel them. But they're there. How do we know they're there? Because you've got a TV set, and as soon as you turn on the TV, each channel picks up a different frequency and turns that frequency, which is unheard, unseen, unfelt, into stark color and sound and tells you a story. And in my experiences as a psychic medium, the infinite intelligence of the universe, whether you want to call it the God energy or the source energy, whatever your words are for this, or the force, as I like to say, sends and has their spirit guides. There's no other way to put it. I don't like to mince words. These are guides that are part of our existence, our metaphysical existence. And they are these frequencies. And a channel is a person who picks them up and delivers those messages. Just really, I like to say, I'm kind of like a TV set.
Okay, let me hold you up. Let me ask you this. I want to make sure we got this because I think it's critically important. Mm. Now, we get there's all of these frequencies moving around. There's it's energy. That when it really comes down to it, it's energy. So effectively, now you're a spirit guide. You have a spirit guide.
Right.
That spirit guide that comes to you,
right,
is that spirit guide tied into your particular energy? The spirit guide is composed of a certain amount of energy, certain combination of energies. Because of that combination, the tie is directly to you. Is that close?
When you say a combination of energies, I'm not really clear about what you mean when the spirit guide is a combination of energies. For me, a spirit guide, in my experience, whether you want to call them angels, they are actually separate beings from yourself that have had many lifetimes on this planet or other planets or other dimensions, and they rise on their journey as a soul and are assisting us. So does the spirit guide that I channel, who wrote the book, whose name is Red Eagle, he's one of many spirit guides that work with me, but he's the one who's delivering a lot of the messages to people. He is connected to me in a very powerful way. I don't know how to describe the connection except for it surprised me just as much as anybody else out there listening. This definitely wasn't the path I was taking with my life. I was a musician my whole life, and this started to happen.
That's energy.
That
in and of itself is. As a matter of fact, think about that. You're out on the dance floor, and you start to dance with somebody, and the music in and of itself takes you to a completely different dimension, and you're in the same place, yet it's all completely different. Where I was at before, that was more of a question than anything else.
Okay.
That energy, that like attracts like. So if there is a, and this is a question now, if there was a particular energy within Red Eagle, is it matched to your energy, and is that where the connection is?
I think it's complementary to my energy because
same.
Yeah. I'm kind of a reserved and I would say I'm kind of reserved and I don't come across with a really loud voice or anything, but Red Eagle is very strong. He's a warrior chief, and the physical age, tricky way to explain this. The quote unquote physical age with which he presents himself to me is older than I am right now. So his voice is that of a much older gentleman than mine, and his energy is, it's complementary to me, where it actually helps me receive that kind of energy because it's not really in my nature to be that way.
Yeah, there was a very specialness about the American Indian, and there was a very specialness about the spirituality of the American Indian. And I haven't been there, but somebody once said that they went to the Little Bighorn where Custer's last stand was, and you could still feel the essence of that battle there also, and there's still the energy of that there. And I really don't think, I don't really think anything ever really dies. The physical body may go, but all of the components that cause that body to be what it is, who it is, how it is, have got to move to somewhere. So
but we leave energetic impressions. Okay, there are, you know, there's a difference when you watch one of those haunted places stories, you know, on television, and they describe a ghost. And for me, a ghost is very different than a spirit. And I'll break it down. Basically, a ghost is a particular energetic impression that has been left in that space, which is why in certain quote-unquote haunted places, you see the same thing over and over again. Oh, there's a guy in a white hat, and he comes out of the door, he looks, and he goes back in the room. And people see the same thing over and over and over again. It is because that person left an energetic impression there. There is no ghost there. There is no being there. It is a vibe that is turned into a visual for you. You know, you walk into a theater when there's no play going on. There's a feeling in the theater. There is an energy in a theater when there's no play going on. If you walk into an office building, it's a completely different feeling when there's no work going on. So people leave their energy in places. Now, a spirit, you're a spirit, I'm a spirit. Some of those who get quote-unquote stuck and are hanging around, that's a different story. But I don't really do that kind of work. That's once in a while I'll do stuff like that.
Sure.
My job and my purpose is to help people awaken to their own intuition and to empower them in that way. And I teach this also. I teach people how to awaken this, their own connection to their spirit guides. Not everyone is supposed to be a transchannel medium, go around doing what I'm doing, but everyone has this sort of birthright to be able to connect.
Now, by the way, there's a club called the Maskers Club, and it's in Hollywood. And it's been around for probably 50, 80 years minimally at this stage of the game. And, you know, Lou Costello and people like that, Jack Benny was involved with it at one time, but Lou Costello was president. And all of these people who are gone now were part of it at one time. And I don't want to get into this, but I was an entertainer years ago. And I remember the very first place I ever played was the Maskers Club. And I remember standing behind, the curtains. You could feel everybody who was ever there behind that curtain. I will never forget that experience for as long as I live and then beyond that. But they were there. I could feel them.
Right. And for me, I say to people when they feel spirits, I'm like, well, just talk to them. What do they want to tell you? Now, there's a big difference between spirits and spirit guides. So I'd like to talk about Red Eagle for a moment.
Please.
Now, working as a psychic medium, like I said, I connect to people's guides and I deliver the messages. I kind of feel like I have an earpiece in an ear and I'm like the translator at the United Nations Assembly where you see that row of translators listening to the speech being spoken in, you know, in French and being translated into Japanese in real time. So when I do readings, I feel like that, like I'm hearing the messages come in one ear and I deliver them out the other. And about 3 years ago, I started receiving messages from a spirit guide named Red Eagle, who identified himself as Red Eagle. And he was a Native American chief, warrior chief, in one particular lifetime about a century ago, and had messages of truth and love and hope and inspiration, and said, I'd like to deliver them through you. And it was an amazing feeling. Now, mind you, my life was as a musician and an artist. The last thing I ever thought that what I would ever be doing is this. It wouldn't be even on a list of the last things I would be doing. Now, it basically was overwhelming, all of these experiences for me, and I ended up doing this with my life. So Red Eagle's mission was to just talk, and we have these gatherings around all over the world, and since Araya and I are based in L.A., we have them weekly or bi-weekly in L.A., and they're called Circle of Light, which you can read about on my website, which is rizmirza.com, and you can find out about, you know, messages about your life, and you come, and Red Eagle, I'm sitting there in the chair, I leave my body, Red Eagle comes in and gives messages. It's great. What ended up happening was he wrote a book while I was in trance, and he dictated, over the course of 13 nights, he dictated a chapter a night. So anybody out there who's listening that has ever tried to write a book, that's pretty amazing. He wrote it in fully final edit form from beginning to end. And then Araya Miller, my partner, she transcribed everything. And now it's out. And we just landed a deal with a publisher. And you can get it on Amazon and Kindle. And we're excited.
Well, you know, we're starting to run out of time, and I could probably talk to you all night. But I'm sitting there listening to you, and I just got this flash, it's like within seconds ago, and the flash was to say thank you to Red Eagle because of what he's doing in the lives that the two of you have touched.
Thank you. I thank him also. I actually thanked him in the book, and it was pretty funny to thank. as I'm writing the thank yous and the dedications, and I went, wow, I wrote a list of a couple of my friends and went, wait, shouldn't I be thanking him? This guy kind of changed my life.
Yeah.
And it's very surreal because who are you thanking? You're thanking this non-physical entity, right?
Yeah.
you know, I want to talk about one or two of the things that he talks about.
I have to do it real quick, and I really hate to say this to you, Rez, we're really getting close to out of time.
Well, let's save it for next time, then. I invite people to come and take a look.
I'd love to have you back on.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, done deal. I'll have Susie Greenman get a hold of you, and then we're on.
Thanks a lot, people.
Good night.
Good night.
The music softly dies, but I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this bit.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
That's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment. And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after.